ones to the a wildly perspective on the sacral design case, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, a case that has stimulated mountains of research and comment for 75 years. This is sponsored by the Industrial Workers of the World, which probably 95% of the movement, so we'll talk in more detail. Steve Kellerman is a longtime friend of mine. He's a labor activist, machinist, labor historian, photographer, and all-around good guy. And Steve will give us a wildly perspective on this much commented upon case.
Okay, well. Okay, thank you, Marty, and good afternoon, friends and fellow workers. And welcome to the War Room. If any of you are disappointed that Peter Sellers and George C. Scott are not in the War Room, my apologies.
This is where the VP of Strategic Planning was up.
Okay, I think...
What's the name of this library, Steve?
The Boston Public Library.
Boston.
Yeah, this is the main facility of the BPL. There are branches all around the city. And the memorabilia we have here are part of the collection of the rare book room. This urn contains a portion of the ashes of Sacco and Vanzetti. They're mixed together. It's about a quarter of the ashes. There are three other urns elsewhere. These are the death masks of Sacco and Vanzetti in the black boxes. These armbands come from the funeral of Sacco and Vanzetti in 1927.
Also put out a letter from Emma Gold talking about the case and the commutation by Governor Lukacs of 1977.
And also, I'll hold these pictures up. These are all part of the collection here at the library. This is a demonstration in favor of Sacco and Vanzetti from, I believe, 1927. This is Sacco and Vanzetti. This is Bartolomeo Vanzetti. This is Sacco and Vanzetti. This is a pretty famous picture. It was redrawn as a painting by Ben Shawn, and it's been widely reproduced. This is a picture of Edna St. Vincent Millay, the famous poet who was one of the many, many people who participated in demonstrations in favor of Sacco and Vanzetti. Here are Sacco and Vanzetti under guard. This is a demonstration. This is the funeral procession. This is Tremont Street in downtown Boston, and this is the beginning of the Boston Common. Several thousand people participated in the funeral procession. This is a picture of Nicola Sacco. This is taken at the same time as the first picture I held up. This is a demonstration. Now this is Luigia Vanzetti, the sister of Bartolomeo, who came over from Italy at the time of the executions. And this is Rosina Sacco, the wife of Nicola Sacco. Another demonstration, this one I believe was in Italy. There were demonstrations all over the world, which I'll get to in greater detail later on. This is a picture of Gene Debs, who was approaching his death at the time that Sacco and Vanzetti were executed, but was active in the campaign to save their lives. This is the funeral procession in Scully Square, Boston. This is Judge Webster Thayer, the prejudiced judge who presided over the frame-up trial. This is Sacco again. Sacco and Vanzetti under guard. Sacco and Vanzetti again under guard. Yeah, they spent the last 7 years of their lives under guard or in jail again. This is Sacco and Vanzetti in Dedham, in the town in which they were tried. And this courthouse is still standing out there. They're all photographs from the collection of Aldino Felicani, which I'll describe in a few minutes. And this is Aldino Felicani as a young man. He was the comrade of Sacco and Vanzetti's who collected all these materials, which he, in his old age, contributed to the Boston Public Library. These are two pictures of... These are the hearses which carry the bodies of Sacco and Vanzetti. This again is Vanzetti's sister and Sacco's wife. The funeral procession. Sacco and Vanzetti under guard. And a close-up of the funeral procession. Okay, now, about Sacco and Vanzetti. First of all, they were not Wobblies. Neither of them ever joined the IWW. They did, at a number of points in their lives, have contact with the IWW. There are actually two Sacco and Vanzetti stories which only connect tangentially. The more famous one that Marty alluded to is the story of the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, the trial and the long drawn out series of appeals and motions that went on for 7 years and eventually their execution. And also all the protests that went on in the United States and all over the world while this was going on. There's a voluminous literature on the case of Sacco and Vanzetti. Literally, hundreds of books have been published, and it's, as the title of one of the books says, it's the case that will not die. It's as alive now as it was in 1927. In the year 1977, on the 50th anniversary of the executions, the then governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis, issued a proclamation that was in the nature of a pardon of Sacco and Vanzetti. And that aroused all kinds of passions among the people who thought that it was a good thing that Sacco and Vanzetti were executed. If there was any kind of a public pronouncement about it now, it would again bring forth all kinds of discussion and emotion. The second Sacco and Vanzetti story is the story of who they actually were. Until 1991, this was almost entirely unknown. But in that year, Paul Avrich, the historian of anarchism, published a book called Sacco and Vanzetti, The Anarchist Background, which tells who they were and what they did. And it's a truly remarkable story. Part of the reason that this didn't happen until 1991 is that for the average historian, anarchism is like the dark side of the moon. They have no understanding of it, no way of approaching it, no way of understanding it if they do come into contact with it. Paul Avrich, on the other hand, has written voluminously on anarchist subjects and is really conversant with the material. And he wrote this book, which I recommend highly. I brought along a reading list of books on the subject. Now, I'll put it out here, and I hope people pick them up on their way out. Anyone who wants to become more familiar with the issue, should check out some of the books, particularly Paul Avrich's book. Okay, now Nicola Sacco, whose birth name was Ferdinando Sacco, he later took the name of a deceased relative, was born in Torre Maggiore, Italy, in the Puglia region. If you can visualize Italy as a boot, the spur of the boot is the Puglia, and that's where Sacco came from. He was born in 1891 to a prosperous peasant family. His father had fairly extensive fields where he raised vegetables and crops, and he was also a wine producer, and he was well enough off to be able to sell wine. An older brother of Sacco's in 1908, the older brother, Sabino, had been in the Italian army. This gave him a kind of a broader breadth of vision than most of the people in the Puglia had access to. And he realized that there was a larger world out there. He also joined the Socialist Party. He came back home after his army service was over and talked to his younger brother, Nicola Sacco, about the two of them moving to America. After a short time, Sacco was convinced that this is something he should do. Sacco was always interested in mechanical kinds of things. He would take motors apart and rebuild them. He loved using the farm machinery that his father had. He went to school for a fairly short period of time, learned to read and write, but was never really a bookish person. Now, Vanzetti was also an immigrant from Italy. He came from the Piedmont region, which is the northwest of Italy, borders on France. The metropolis of the Piedmont is Genoa, which has been in the news considerably in the recent past. Vanzetti was born in 1888, also to a prosperous farming family. He started going to school, and his father withdrew him before he completed his education and apprenticed him to a pastry chef. Vanzetti always was sorry not to have completed his education. He was a voracious reader and was an autodidact. He was self-taught. He learned to be a pastry chef, but it was something he never liked very much. In fact, he hated it. The times that he practiced his trade, he always did it against his will and as a matter of necessity. He hated indoor work in general. In fact, he hated being indoors. He loved being outside. He was very romantic by nature. He loved seeing the trees, the birds, the grass, the sky. And America, to both Sacco and Vanzetti in 1908, it embodied for them the idea of progress and of freedom. Neither of them were radicals as they were growing up. As I said, before Sacco came into contact with the Socialist Party through his brother's membership, but neither of them were committed radicals in any sense. Sacco, in 1908, arrived in Boston. This was his port of entry. Vanzetti, just a short time later, arrived in New York City. They did not know one another at the time. When Sacco first got here, he worked on construction jobs, which for Italian immigrants was the most common type of work. It was unskilled, very low paid. The work was hard. The treatment was awful. The conditions were poor. After a fairly short time, he realized that there was no future for him in construction, and he found out that a guy named Kelly was teaching the trade of shoe trimmer. Shoe manufacturing was one of the major industries in Massachusetts at that time, and so Sacco got himself into this program. He had to pay tuition for it, and he had to work learning the trade for several months without pay, which was a considerable hardship at the time. But he went through it, and being the mechanically gifted person he was, he ended up becoming one of the best shoe trimmers in the industry. And this was a skilled trade at which he could earn a pretty good living. While he was looking around and learning the ropes in America, he noticed things that were apparent to many of us, the class nature of society, the oppression and exploitation of the workers, and he was repelled by this. It's pretty bad now. It was even worse at the turn of the 20th century. Also, at that time, Italians were the subject of a really atrocious kind of prejudice. They were hated and feared by many of the older residents in America. They were thought to all carry stilettos, be violent people, be unassimilable, uneducatable. They were actually considered to be non-white, which in the early years of the 20th century, to be non-white in America was to be a total outcast. This was the period of mass lynchings and black people in the South being disenfranchised, segregation every place. And the Italians had a very hard time of it. As Sacco looked around, he came into some contact with the IWW, which at the time was quite prominent and well-known, and found IWW doctrines very attractive. Particularly, he was influenced by the 1912 strike in Lawrence, in which the mill operatives working for the Woolen Trust went out on a general strike against working conditions that were unimaginably bad. And Sacco thought this was a wonderful thing and became active in the strike support that went on where he was living down in the area around Milford, Massachusetts. And strike support went on all over New England. It was a very well-publicized event. But Sacco also at the same time came into contact with anarchists, anarchist communists, members of the Galliani Circle. He found them to be very attractive people. They were passionately devoted to the idea of complete freedom. They were opposed to any kind of organization such as what the IWW practiced. And he ended up joining the Galliani Circle. He subscribed to the newspaper, the Cronica Sovversiva, which was edited by Luigi Galliani. I'll say more about him later. And Sacco became a kind of Jimmy Higgins in the socialist movement. Jimmy Higgins is a kind of mythological character, the rank-and-file member of the Socialist Party who does all the work that's needed to be done without looking for personal advancement or personal aggrandizement. The kind of rank-and-file member who keeps every movement going. And that's the kind of role that Sacco played in the Galliani anarchist circle. In 1913, a strike broke out in Hopedale at the Draper Manufacturing Company, which made equipment for the textile mills. Sacco had actually worked in that factory at an earlier time, and he was living nearby. He became extremely active in the strike. He spoke, raised funds, held meetings on the streets. A few years later, during the IWW strike on the Mesabi Range in Minnesota, the Great Iron Range, Sacco again was very active and ended up being arrested for the only time in his life prior to 1920. That case was thrown out. He really didn't have any kind of criminal record. Sacco was, as I said, a very idealistic person. He wasn't a subtle thinker or a philosopher, but he was passionately devoted to the idea of freedom and was very committed. Vanzetti was a different type of a person, as I said earlier. He was an intellectual, a bookish person. He read all the time. He was kind of a drifter. When he first arrived in America, he started also working on construction work and doing the same type of jobs that Sacco found, and which many Italian immigrants found. And that was the type of work he continued to do. It was like casual labor. He would have a job for a few weeks, like helping to maintain railroad tracks, digging ditches, hod carrying on construction sites. He also did a little indoor work. He hated every minute of it. Felt that he was like imprisoned. And he was in general like either unable or unwilling or both to fit into the kind of discipline that capitalism requires. Let's see. In 1913, he ended up moving to Plymouth, Massachusetts, where he remained for the rest of his life as a free man. He had been very unhappy working as a casual laborer. When there was no work around, he went through periods of near starvation. When there was work, it was like heavy, difficult, brutal work. But as long as it was outdoors, he was willing to put up with it. When he first got to Plymouth, he moved in with a family named Brini, who were the possessors of another urn of the Sacco and Vanzetti ashes. The Brinis ran a boarding house for people who, for Italian immigrants working in Plymouth, and Vanzetti became like a member of their family. He helped raise the children. He was loved as a member of the family. One of his first jobs in Plymouth was working for the Cordage Trust, which was the American Cordage Company, the largest producer of rope and cord in the world at that time. The Cordage Park, which is now an office park and I think luxury condos. If you ever get to Plymouth, you should take a look at it and just to see the size of the installation. Vanzetti was fairly happy working there at first. The work was booming because of the war in Europe, which had started in 1914. The Allied countries put in huge orders for rope and for their war effort, and so there was a lot of work. In fact, there was so much work that Vanzetti was ordered to move indoors at the Cordage plant and work on the machines, and he quit after a short time, again not being able to stand working indoors. Prior to that, he had been loading railroad cars with the finished products at the factory, which was all right for him. And thereafter, he bounced around again from job to job. In 1916, an unexpected strike broke out in the Cordage plant. Vanzetti was still living in Plymouth at the time. The issues were low pay. In spite of the fact that the cost of living was skyrocketing, particularly the cost of basic food products. There were food riots that went on in Plymouth at that time and in other towns around New England. And the workers workers of the Cordage Trust realized that the company was raking in immense profits. This is the same type of stuff that was going on in every industry during the war. The industries that were producing for the war, the owners were bringing in record profits and trying to hold the line on wages. And where the workers weren't organized to do anything about it, they were paying the price of declining living standards. And this is standards for people who were living very close to the edge. So they went out on a spontaneous strike in 1916. Vanzetti jumped in with both feet. He became, even though he was no longer working for the Cordage, he became extremely active in the strike. He spoke, traveled around New England to raise funds, wrote articles for the anarchist press. The AF&L and the IWW both sent organizers in to try to sign up the Cordage workers. Vanzetti and most of the other workers at the plant opposed both the AF&L and the IWW. Vanzetti because he was an anarchist who wanted no part of organization. He felt that if they were in a permanent organization, that they would be taking orders from officials and would lose control over their own affairs. Eventually, the strikers ended up settling for a wage increase of $1 an hour across the board for everyone, regardless of what they made. This was insufficient, but the workers were tired. They had been out on strike for over a month by then. Most of them didn't share Vanzetti's perspective that what they were doing was making the revolution. They just wanted to go back to work and have the paychecks start rolling in again. But that was a major event in Vanzetti's life and education. Okay, now the Galliani Circle, the anarchist group that they joined, was inspired by Luigi Galliani. He also was an Italian immigrant, somewhat older than Sacco and Vanzetti. He had trained as a lawyer in Italy, and by the time he graduated, he was thoroughly disgusted with the law and never practiced it. He became an anarchist and an agitator, both in Italy and France. The reason he was in France is that the police were on his trail in Italy. He was a great speaker by all accounts. He was passionate. He had a kind of tremolo when he spoke that was very effective. I think probably to people living in the year 2001, it would seem affected, but in those days, there was a kind of standard of oratory that that allowed people to appreciate Galliani's style. He was also a newspaper editor and a pamphleteer. He moved to the United States in 1900, again because the police were making it uncomfortable for him in Italy and France. He first settled in Paterson, New Jersey, which was the center of Italian anarchism and had been since the 1880s. He took over the editorship of the best-known Italian anarchist publication of the time, the name of which I cannot recall right now, edited it from Paterson. And the early teens, a strike broke out among the silk workers in Paterson. Galliani became very active in the strike. Some people were killed during a clash on the picket line, and the police decided, to, as usual, to charge Galliani with being responsible for the deaths. Galliani went to Canada to escape the police, and then snuck back into the United States and settled in Barrie, Vermont. Barrie, at that time, was a quarry city, and a lot of the people who worked in the stone quarries were Italian immigrants from Carrara, Italy.